any kind.
You always try to see something constructive in it. That it's bad that it happened, but now let's see what we can learn from it, so you can go on from there. And in this way, it can be assimilated in some way. Whether it's something you did yourself or it's something that happened to you from the outside, you have to be able to put some kind of constructive, get something positive out of it. After all, Prabhupada said once, you learn from experience, and experience means you make mistakes. So this making a mistake is not really the problem. Not learning from the mistakes is the real problem. So if you can learn from it, then that's putting a constructive interpretation on an experience. Well, at least you learn from this. Just like when the whole GBC went through this whole crisis with Narayan Maharaj, we managed to come out learning a lot, all of us, about, you know, what it meant to follow Srila Prabhupada. And so we could see, well, there was something constructive in it. So in all these ways, there's something like that. So he says his objective, now at the end of the paragraph, my objective is always to assist. So again, he sees himself in an assisting role. He's not doing it. You're not doing it for other people. You're helping them do it for themselves. This is really an important point. My objective is always to assist the better self in its effort to win out on the face of odds. And now he lays down this important point, which I've already mentioned. In all my efforts, I rely upon a simple principle derived from my theological training, which seems to me far too little understood. I refer to the view that the real evil in mental disorder is not to be found in the conflict, that is, which caused the disorder, but in the sense of isolation or estrangement. It is the fear and guilt which results from the presence in one's life of that which one is afraid to tell. For this reason, I do not consider it necessary to lower the conscience threshold in order to get rid of the conflict. What is needed is forgiveness and restoration to the fellowship of that social something which we call God. In common with psychiatrists, generally, I therefore try to get the patient to talk, and I am careful never to permit myself to be shocked by any deviations from accepted standards which he may disclose. So here's the really important point. I then try to shift the basis of self-respect from the rigid or static type of morality to the dynamic type. I try to get him to see that no matter how unworthy one may have been, he is a good man and worthy of honor insofar as he is earnestly seeking to become better. So notice earlier he says he is trying to restore shaken self-confidence. So one thing is a person in this condition is thinking, I'm bad, I'm evil, I'm fallen, I'm, you know, and is often so discouraged, doesn't think there's anything I can do to try. So that's because the basis of self-respect may have been put on a rigid basis, that if you do certain things, you're bad. But what he wants to emphasize in this context is that no matter how unworthy one may have been, he's not denying that the things they did were bad. He doesn't say to him, oh, no, that's not so bad. But no matter what you've done that bad, you're good and worthy of honor insofar as you are earnestly seeking to become better. So obviously this person wants to become better, otherwise they wouldn't be feeling bad to begin with. You know. So one just has to encourage them. So a large part of Krishna consciousness, and in fact a large part of the even philosophy of Krishna consciousness, is just to show that Krishna consciousness is not impossible. You know? I mean, what philosophy does is clear away mental doubts. That is it possible? Is it possible to become free from the contamination of the modes of material nature? Is transcendence possible? Is pure devotional service possible? Is there such a thing? How can I do it? And so on. So people have to have confidence or enthusiasm in Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada has said that faith is created by association with devotees. That is to say, if our faith or confidence is shaken, then we have to associate with people whose confidence isn't shaken. And in this case, the person who's trying to help the other person has to be himself confident or assured. Yeah.
When you're talking about helping the person's life, if they're not interested in it, in the sense that maybe their reaction or whatever is so strong that, I mean, not everybody even has it together enough to understand what they're suffering, you know. And so do you just leave those people who hope that by chanting Hare Krishna eventually they'll...
Well, here I think one has to develop practical wisdom in dealing with people. There are some you can help, and there's some you can't. Maybe somebody else can help, but you can't, depending on the relationship. Because as we learned yesterday, you know, the most important thing is to be able to establish a certain kind of relationship with trust. Maybe you can't do that for whatever reason. So that's one thing. Or maybe the other person is so much in a pattern of concealment that you can't do anything about it. Then there are borderline cases. Then you just have to make a judgment call. And sometimes, he'll talk later in this chapter about waiting for the opportune moment. But you see, if the minister, we'll call him the minister, if the minister is conscious of where everybody is at, is tracking everybody in their care spiritually, then we understand this person has an unfaced conflict. And then when some circumstances happen, then you can understand now's the time where I can approach this person. If I approach this person at the wrong time, you know, I may make things worse. We'll see that. So that now he says, at the page of 268. The task of the ordinary pastor, I think, is not greatly different from what he does in the mental hospital. Now imagine ourselves. Now, the Krishna consciousness movement is going to... Tukaram, wake up. Hey, Tukaram. You're sleeping. Imagine yourself... As ISKCON develops, there are going to be huge communities of devotees. You're going to have people, all kinds of people, who will be part of your community. In an early part of ISKCON, you know, we thought that, well, we just dealt with people's spiritual life and we didn't deal with their material problems. But if you have devotees in your community that have material problems and they're in your care, you have to take care of them. And that will happen more and more. So he says, the task of the ordinary pastor is not greatly different. He also will have the sick and the aged and those who are slaves of a situation in some unfortunate circumstance they can't get out of. In his parish, he finds all the reaction patterns which we find here in the hospital. He merely sees in the more complex, incipient, that is, beginning forms, what we see in the exaggerated and simplified terminal stages. He will have in his group those who are growing in the direction of unification on the basis of the Christian ideal. Read Vaishnava. Same thing, huh? He will have those who, while professing adherence to the faith of their fathers, have never taken it seriously and have allowed their problems to accumulate. He will have those whose beliefs have suffered some degree of distortion as a means of escaping the sense of personal failure. Persons who attempt to have maintained their loyalties without paying the price of growth, and to this end resort to all sorts of compromises and protective devices, which we have studied. Right? He will have those who make no pretense at conforming to the faith of their fathers and yet are comfortable about it. He will have those who, through frank delinquency or mental illness, are outside the pale. I mean, beyond the socialization. And then he will have the distressed. Those who, suddenly subjected to the strain of bereavement or of business reverse bereavement, you know, grief when somebody dies or gets mortally ill or something like that, or of business reverses, are seeking desperately for those values that cannot be taken away. They've lost something material, now they're looking for something eternal. Right? A common enough thing. Or those who are torn with conflict in the effort to bring the instinctual drives into conformity with the requirements of a new stage of development. In some cases, he may have those who are undergoing the stress and turmoil of a mutation process in whom, as in the case of John Bunyan, some higher possibility is seeking to come to birth. People with an acute spiritual crisis, which may be confused with mental disease. So that's that list, right? Pretty good list, huh? Notice this sentence, next sentence. Toward all of these, the pastor will have obligations. I like this word obligations, you know, if I may. Sometimes those of us from America, we like to talk about rights. Like a lot of people are talking about, you know, putting a bill of rights of devotees into a constitution of ISKCON. But there's something to me that's hardly, doesn't sound like devotee like to say, oh, this, I have this right or I have that right. But if you look at what, anytime anybody has a right, what it really means is that somebody else has obligations. And a right's useless unless it's translated into somebody else's obligation. Somebody's duty towards somebody else. So really, as devotees, we should be concerned about our obligations toward others. So anyone who is in a position of a pastor, a religious leader, that list that's in the Bhagavatam, beginning with teacher, demigod, political leader, parent, gurus, all these have obligations. I mean, they have the obligation of their dependents to save them from debt, right? So anytime one comes into a position of leadership, or a brahminical position, the position of a minister or a pastor, however one want to call it, to care for people, then there are obligations. If you're a temple president, a bhakta leader, a bhaktin leader, a temple commander, a congregational development leader, there's a group of people toward whom you have obligations. Things you ought to do. So this is his... And I think in ISKCON, for many years, we ignored our obligations. We really disowned people to whom we should have had obligations. So he says here, notice this list, because you will find yourself not being able to walk away from them. The aged, the lonely, the chronic invalid, and those who are carrying on in the face of difficulty will need all the comfort and encouragement which it lies in his power to give. You can't maybe solve their problems for them, but you can do what you can do. And the group of faithful, that is to say those who are really properly situated in their determination, whose recognized leader he is, constitute an invaluable resource. This is a very interesting observation. Through them, he can greatly multiply his own effectiveness by engaging them in service. It must ever be his task to give them the enlightenment and the guidance necessary for their most effective service. And few of them will there be who do not have their own problems and difficulties. Temple devotees, this is usually, but others also. Then he notices other people, those whose attitudes and values are distorted by unacceptable subconscious desires, which they have not been able to bring under control. He says, from our hospital experience, he may learn how difficult it is to change such people and how futile it is to reason or argue with them. They just can't do a thing. They don't go away. They're in your somehow or other sphere, but you can't do a thing with them, right? He may often have reason to wish that they might be consigned to our care, that is, sent to the mental hospital instead of hanging around. But an understanding of human nature may enable him to get along with them. At least you should understand what's going on. And even to modify their system of belief by question and suggestion, used skillfully enough to enable them to change without damage to their self-respect. Do you understand what he's saying here? There are going to be some people that if you challenge the fictitious basis of their self-respect, they'll just become angry and go away. But you might be able, without directly confronting them with their defenses, by flattery, by service, by so many things, to somehow or other get them to come to see something. That maybe they could make it think it's their own idea that they could do something to change. So, for example, when I told you how I dealt with this one person a few days ago, I mentioned at Gita Nagari, where I directly challenged, his system of fictitious self-importance and so on. The better thing would have been, if it were possible, maybe he was too far gone, but to realize, what's going to happen if I confront him directly with his defenses, which are so impregnable, but maybe there's some other way you can go over, under, or around, or through. So that's another thing that a person has to see. Now, here's another group. In the case of those who have rejected the faith of their fathers, he will have a problem no less difficult. In their eyes, he will have no prestige by virtue of his vocation, but rather the reverse. In other words, like for somebody, there may be a group of people for whom the fact that I am a spiritual master may give me something, some position to help them. That same thing, another group of people are going to damn me in certain people's eyes. For example, certain members of the second generation. The last guy they want to talk to is a GBC, a guru, or people like that, right? In their eyes, he will have no prestige by virtue of his vocation. Rather, the reverse. So you just can't come in and say, this is my title, respect me. Right? So now listen, he gives some shrewd advice here that you can transfer to our own situation very nicely. Whatever he accomplishes with this group must be on his own merit by winning prestige on their terms. It is important for him to understand that standards are commonly functions of the loyalties, and that in the case of those who have rebelled against their primary loyalties and have identified himself with some group of alien standards, the standards will not be changed apart from personal relations. In other words, you understand what he's saying. You can't just go in and say, the regular principles say this and this. Rather, somehow or other, if they can come to like you on the basis of a personal relation, then they'll come to accept your standard, not vice versa. The fact that you uphold certain standards won't make them like you. Rather, just the reverse. But if somehow or other they come to, for other things, come to like or trust you, then they may appreciate your standards. Because they like somebody else who has different standards right now. They have some other leader or some other model that they are following. Who that may be, that depends on the circumstances. Because he goes on to say, just let me finish this. The delinquent who has found social support among birds of his own feather and worships at the shrine of Dillinger and Capone, these are famous American gangsters, can only be changed insofar as he learns to accept another type of hero. It will never be possible to change the attitude of such a person, either by force or by reason, but only through the power of admiration and affection. So that's the principle. Now, in applying that principle, and normally when we preach, to, when people become devotees, it's because there's something about devotees that they like. They cannot say what it is, a certain je ne sais quoi, I don't know, I just like them. They may not like us because we follow the principles. They may think that's the downside, but there's something about them that I like. They're attracted. And then because they're attracted, then they think, I want to become like you. So that's always a principle. So let me just finish this part. How far it will be worthwhile for the minister to attempt this, that is, win admiration and affection, will depend largely upon his own qualifications. Here you got to be shrewd, you know. And then he mentions how a psychoanalyst said, I'll take anyone with whom I can establish a transference, the same principle. This principle applies to the minister. If he is one who is able to win the respect and the affection of the delinquent and the roughneck, like the six Goswamis, right, dear to the devotees and the gentle and the ruffian alike, right? Or of the social rebel of whatever variety, he can get results. But let him beware of trying to masquerade as a sheep in wolf's clothing. You understand that reference, you know? The biblical reference is to beware of a wolf in a sheep's clothing. That is the sinful person who pretends to be pious. He says the other thing that looks ridiculous is where some guy who's pious, in order to win the affection of delinquents, you know, tries to cuss and use bad words and act like that, you know. In the case of the delinquent, he is certainly not going to raise the boy to a higher level, except as he may be able to, through friendship and understanding, to bridge the gulf, the chasm, and win the boy's loyalty in his own true role as representative of society at his best. So this is just very good practical experience. And the same thing, I think, can be applied in art, the kind of people we have to deal with. If we have second guru coolies, you see them around here. They're coming around. They dress half devotees, half not devotees. You know, announcing with their language of clothes just where they stand. And they got, you know, what's called attitude with a capital A. And one has to deal with them. Now, who is to deal with them? Maybe it's not anybody official, but somebody. But the general principles will be these people or other people who have somehow or other are attracted to ISKCON, but at the same time rebel against certain things in ISKCON for whatever reasons. Let me say something about adolescent rebellion. One reason that adolescents typically rebel against the values of their elders is because of the hypocrisy they see. You see, like What young people particularly like, they understand the ideals of a society and they take them to heart. And then they want to put them in effect. And then they look at the people who are preaching those ideals and see that they fall short. Now, young people in their judgment are particularly ruthless and unforgiving, because they have no practical experience of the difficulty of living up to those ideals. You know, they're a little arrogant and full of themselves. And they think I can do it. They have no practical experience. So that way they judge their elders very harshly. Where those of us who have had the experience of difficulty, we're at least a little more tolerant of human failures and weaknesses, because we've seen how hard it is for people over the long run to maintain a very high standard. In fact, those of us who have been around long enough even appreciate a little bit of hypocrisy, quite frankly. I mean, it just makes things nice if we don't have to have, you know, what everybody's doing in front of your face all the time. We know what everybody is, you know, backslide, but it's nice to put on appearances once in a while. After all, Oscar Wilde said that hypocrisy is the homage that vice pays to virtue. So at least something is there. There's some homage, you know. When vice just throws into your face, you know, it gets a little wearisome.
At least
they're recognized. Yeah, right. So, I mean, you have to be kind of old and world-weary, I guess, to appreciate hypocrisy, the upside of it. But young people have no use for it whatsoever. But seeing this hypocrisy, because young people are very idealistic and they have no practical experience of practical difficulties, they're a little ruthless in their judgment. And that may also cause them to rebel. And then what happens, then when they find they have some difficulty, then they use the hypocrisy they see in the community around them as an excuse to evade the difficulty. And Boyson talks about that, about so in some other chapter he has a sentence, which, boy, that really hit me, because that's precisely what I did as a kid, you know, growing up in an ostensibly Christian community. Was exactly, deep in my heart, I knew, you know, what I was being called upon to do. Even in a Christian community. I mean, somehow or other the message of Jesus got through all the fog and the smoke. And you know, at a certain level, I knew exactly what I was being called to do. But because I saw so much hypocrisy around me, on one level, I didn't, you know, I rejected it because of these people didn't do it. But I was, in one sense, I could use it to evade it. And then that's what I did myself. And in this, I was reinforced by no less a personage than my father, who had done the same thing in his youth. But that's also an evasion technique. So really, we cannot, and many, many people, because they see in ISKCON there are so many hypocrites, then they think, why should I try? But the fact that there's so many hypocrites doesn't mean that you shouldn't try, or doesn't mean that the values are any less true. And so one uses it as an excuse to evade this. Of course, one should not try to give people this excuse. And hopefully there's a few people who aren't hypocrites. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that sometimes those people become very hard to see. As the Beatles once sang in a song, you got to be good looking because you're so hard to see. Right? So those people are sometimes...
too low profile.
Either too low profile or they're... they're just absent. Yeah. Yeah. Or, yeah. Any, you wanted to say something about this topic?
Just, you said something around it that you said that you have to be more attractive as a person than the people who they look up to now. And I really struggle.
Yeah, that's true. To get people to re-socialize into ISKCON, that means devotees have to be more attractive. than the people that they presently have as their, what do they call them, role models? I hate to use these cliches, but these role models. Everybody's got one, some ideal person. Maybe it's embodied in somebody, or maybe it's a composite in their mind. But you have to be more... What was Prabhupada's definition? Prabhupada gave one very famous definition of a Vaishnava. Yeah, but another definition also. When you see him, you want to become a Vaishnava too. Yeah? Isn't that, you've heard that one before, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The other one is a perfect gentleman. You will not be able to find any fault in him. Prabhupada went on to elaborate.
And also, so
that's, he's translating the word sadhu, by the way.
And you'll think of Krishna.
Yeah, but he said, the other thing is when you see him, you want to become just like him. I want to become just like him. And actually, I mean, that's what, in that sense, I said I'd join the movement in spite of the devotees. But the original thing was I wanted to be just like them, because it was their commitment and their renunciation that attracted me. Their social dealings were the tough part. But the other aspects of the devotees was obviously very attractive. It weren't for the purity. But it's funny, you see, the thing that makes us attracted to devotees, the purity, is also the thing that makes it difficult to be a devotee, the purity. And there, that the very thing that attracts you is the very thing that becomes the barrier.
Purity is the farce.
Yeah, as somebody once said, purity is the farce. So people become in a bind. So is there some way we can get the appearance or the effect of purity without actually having it? This is the cheating propensity. And that's when you get all the concealment devices and everything like that. It's such an easy thing to fall into. I mean, it's certainly understandable. But the very thing that attracts you becomes the very thing that makes it most difficult. Because people have thought that, you know, people have proposed at different times, if we just lowered our standards, it would be so much easier, you know, for ISKCON to get so many people. But that would also make it that much less attractive to those same people. It really would. If it just lowered its standards. But people are always... The history of religion is lowering standards. My God, look what happened to Buddhism. You know, their standards in the beginning, it was a community of monks that was really so rigorous. And more... You know, there were lay people, that is to say householders, not monks and nuns, who were, you know, funded the monasteries and everything, and more they wanted a piece, they wanted, and finally, because they were big donors, they began to lower the standard to accommodate those people. And, you know, so, you know, how many Buddhists do you meet that actually even understand that you should be vegetarians? Well, only on certain days or whatever. Yeah, it's Dharma Shiglani. This is how it comes about all the time. You know, Kaitava Dharma, cheating religion. You know? And it's the perennial problem. And it's also our problem all the time. And what at least what you see in Boysen is somebody, at least from a Christian community, who's got a really clear idea of the goal. This is what's attractive to me. He's got a real clear idea of the goal. Who sees everybody, he sees the faults of this Christian community with, you know, no illusions whatsoever. And he's still committed to them. I mean, that's really far out, you know, because many of us will want to throw up our hands and quit. And you just can't do it. We have obligations. But I understand, you know, what the system of Varnashram Dharma, I think, is supposed to do. It's allow people to be socialized on different platforms and yet at the same time maintain the high ideal.
It's also, they have the segregation between musicians, social groups. So
That's true.
Certain standards, they would be, like the Brahmins had a certain standard, and Kshatriyas had their standard, and the Vaishyas had their standard.
Yeah. Yeah, the Vedic solution to this problem is a very, very interesting one. But it also underwent Dharma Shigrani. You know? And what Prabhupada blames in the corruption of the Brahmanas is, you know, all the way down to the partitioning of India. You know, the Asuric Varnashram Dharma, where people became Brahmins simply by birth, which is, became the sufficient qualification. Anyway, let's keep on going here. So he's talking about those. Then he goes on to each, every parish has its own representatives of the down and outs. Now, generally we used to ship these people out. Send them back to their parents. The people who are beyond help, who are mentally ill, who are totally criminal, who are alcoholic, who are helpless, you know. Helpless and hopeless. People that usually have to be committed to some institution or another. And there are those also. Anyway, he says, but then he says, but the greatest opportunity of the pastor is, this is on page 271, I think with the distressed, those who are in jeopardy, danger of some kind, with those who are passing through periods of acute crisis and mutation. So here we get exactly the group that are Artharti, you know, going through physical, emotional, financial, painful reverses of some kind. He says, in the case of the bereaved, that is someone who had a death in the family, or the physically ill, he may find a readiness to think about the things that really matter. Where before, other interests and cares had crowded out the ultimate values. Precisely. You know, you can take advantage. What was it called? The Shmasana Vairagya? Yeah. You can take advantage of that. At such times, he may find a response. And second of all, if people have heard the truth most of their lives and yet not acted on it, sometimes at a period of crisis, then it comes home to them. Or they've heard it and acted on it and put it on the back burner. Suddenly when they understand, when something happens, it may come back. At such times, he may find a responsiveness which will not be found in other circumstances. And if he has the necessary understanding and delicacy of touch, that's something that's needed. What the Germans call what? Fingerspitzengefühl, fingertip sensitivity, you know? Delicacy of touch. He may help more than one of these to solve the problems on the level of the religious. In the case of those who have met with business reverses and economic catastrophe, there is likely to be a similar opportunity. And he gives some history of this. You know, at that time he was writing this, the United States was still in an economic depression. And then he goes on to talk about how to deal with sex desire, which I've already read about that, about his ideas about some kind of leading people toward a sublimation. That to say adultery or masturbation is okay is not the way, and that sex desire has to be controlled and ultimately sublimated into some kind of relationship that produces a higher type of human being. Sounds like what he's talking about, what we talk about when we talk about Garbhadhanhana Samskara, although I'm not sure. But it's amazing sort of how close it sounds. I already read that passage at the beginning. And again, later on in that chapter, you don't have this part, when he talks about counseling people. Here he's talking about dealing with people with sex desire, which they can't control, or having difficulty control. It cannot be too strongly emphasized, you don't have this, that it is possible to do this. Let me see. In dealing with those who are struggling for self-mastery against unacceptable instinctual claims, it is first of all important to help them feel that love and not fear is the one true basis of all ethical codes and morality, rightly understood, and that morality, rightly understood, is a matter of inner attitude and purpose rather than of outward conformity. I would put it a little differently. I mean, the conformity to the rules and regulations is what you ultimately want. But what we start with is the inner attitude. Do you want to conform? And the desire to conform. If that desire is there and you're willing to work, then you're good. Is that under what?
What if we've seen sometimes that people, let's say, are outwardly conforming, but inwardly their desire is either stunted or is deteriorating?
Desire? What do you mean, is stunted? They're,
in other words, he's talking about maybe internal development versus external development,
mm-hmm.
or rightness and motivation versus external symptoms of behavior.
Yeah.
So you were saying, and you were adjusting and saying you need to have the internal, but the goal is to follow externally as well.
Yeah, of course. We want to come people up to the highest standard. He also recognizes that also. I mean, Boysen isn't wrong here. The way he puts it may be a little misleading.
So I was, a lot of times, or sometimes, you see devotees who are following externally, but internally they're deteriorating or they're eating away themselves or they've lost sight of the goal. And
that's
it's just
right.
a matter of time until they leave.
Yeah, sure.
So that even the idea that, you know, the goal is to fall externally, I mean, obviously that's the case.
Well, no, sure. But with those people, if they are too afraid to tell, then you're not going to be able to help them. The first step is they've got to be somebody they can confide in. In the recent unfortunate case with Jagadish where this was happening, according to that letter that he wrote, he had had certain desires which he had not discussed, as far as we know, of long-standing. He had had one of his best friends in the Krishna conscious movement just before he left us, or left Sannyas Ashram, with him. And this person reports he didn't mention this problem. So here was a person who understood in some ways for everybody else the necessity of having somebody to confide in. Although maybe some of that was going on, obviously, inappropriately. But wasn't doing it himself with the appropriate people. Unfortunately, couldn't bring himself to do it. And I attribute this to the fact that he was socialized in ISKCON in the very early days, where, in fact, there were certain habits of being walled off that he never got over. You know. Because it was definitely, as if you read that 84 paper I wrote, that was definitely the style in ISKCON in those days. People simply, as soon as you confessed, you were jumped on, condemned, jumped, you know, and people learned very quickly not to say anything. And so this may have been a holdover from those early days in his case, unfortunately. But so here, once a relationship is established, then it comes out. Now, this involves, you know, sometimes discussing. Let me finish reading this passage, huh?